Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, welcome to Radio Islam International. Welcome to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your hostess, Zeenat. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The time right now is 8 minutes past two. First up this afternoon is health news. And this afternoon we look at using flaxseed to ease constipation and IBS symptoms. We'll be looking at it, just quickly and briefly what it is, nutritional and health benefits of it. And, using flaxseed for IBS and when you are using it, what to keep in mind. Also, how to use it, very briefly. That will be followed by Family Health Matters, and joining me this afternoon is our team of therapists from the Indonesia Community-Based Rehabilitation Center. We have Trish, Kendall, and Nazreen. Trish, as you know, is our physio. Trish Venturio is a physio. Kendall Greeley is the occupational therapy. And Nazreen Hassam, the occupational therapist. She's also the sub-district coordinator for the Johannesburg Metro District. Our topic this afternoon is cerebral palsy, and we're also going to be talking about hippotherapy. Now, I'm sure many of you would perhaps know about it, may not know about it, but we will be here to inform you about it, inshallah. This is an interactive program, so please do call in with your input, your questions, or your concerns. The number to dial, 011-854-1548, that's the studio number, or you can also WhatsApp or SMS me on the number 082-8492-786. Now, back to health news this afternoon. Using flaxseed to ease constipation and IBS symptoms. Now, I don't know if you know, but flaxseed is also known as linseed. They are actually tiny seeds from the flax plant. And because of their nutritional makeup, flaxseed has been investigated as a way to address the symptoms of, many health conditions, including constipation. Now, let's just learn a little about flaxseed so that we can make an informed decision as to whether it would be a good thing to add to your diet or to ease your symptoms of constipation or even irritable bowel syndrome, that is IBS. What is flaxseed? Well, the flaxseed plant has a long history of being used by humans for a wide variety of uses. The leaves, the stems, and the seeds of the flax plant have been used for clothing, in cooking, and also for medicinal purposes, as well as in the manufacture of many worldwide goods. More specifically, flax seeds are the tiny sesame seed-like or sesame seed size from the plant. They are about the size of sesame seeds. And although flax seeds can be eaten whole, grinding the seeds allows the body to fully benefit from flaxseed's many nutritional benefits. So let's look at some of its nutritional benefits. When eaten in ground form, flaxseed offers a wealth of healthful nutrients. It's considered a good source of the following: protein, omega-3 fatty acids, dietary fiber, particularly the soluble fiber, and also vitamins, minerals, and the phytochemical lignin. And they say that research on animals in laboratories and some preliminary studies with humans who have certain diseases have found evidence that flaxseed may improve heart health, lower cholesterol levels, reduce the risk of certain cancers, that's breast, colon, prostate, and also ease the symptoms of menopause. Of course, larger studies will be needed to be conducted before any firm conclusions can be made about the helpfulness of flaxseed for these health problems. Still, these findings are exciting and nonetheless. Now, using flaxseed for IBS. Although most studies have been done with laboratory animals, one small study on about 55 humans with constipation predominant IBS found that flaxseed may not only help ease constipation, but may also help to reduce bloating and abdominal pain. And then some experts speculate that mechanism behind flaxseed is that it is effective in speeding up intestinal movement, resulting in an increased frequency of bowel movements. Animal studies suggest that flaxseed may not only ease the symptoms of constipation, but may also help to ease diarrhea due to its effect on stool formation. That being said, if you have diarrhea predominant IBS and you decide to give flaxseed a try, you may want to start with a very small dose to allow your body time to adjust. Although there is no research on the subject, it is possible that flaxseed might be a nice option for you if you have alternating type IBS, as the increase in fiber might theoretically help to stabilize the makeup of the stool. And on the flip side, it's worthy to note that another small study of 31 people with IBS found that flaxseed did not improve stool frequency or consistency. So with that, more research is needed to better understand the role of flaxseed as a way to ease IBS symptoms. But there's a few things that you should keep in mind when you are using flaxseed. It is important to consider the shelf life requirements when deciding which form of flaxseed to use. Whole flaxseed has a shelf life of up to 1 year. Ground flaxseed should be refrigerated and used within a few months. Flaxseed oil must be refrigerated to keep it from growing rancid and should be used within a few weeks. It is also important to bear in mind that flaxseed oil lacks fiber, and some of the other major nutritional benefits of flaxseed in its seed form. Now, let's just see how to use flaxseed, because many of us may not be quite certain how to use it. Now, you have the option to buy flaxseed pre-ground or to use a small coffee grinder to grind your own. Flaxseed has a pleasant nutty taste, and if you decide to introduce flaxseed into your diet, do so gradually and then work your way up to about 2 tablespoons per day. Also, make sure to drink lots of water when consuming flaxseed, and here's just some ways to incorporate it into your daily diet. You can sprinkle ground flaxseed on cereal or yogurt. You can add ground flaxseed to baked goods. You can add ground flaxseed to smoothies. And you can fold ground flaxseed into your favorite meatloaf or your sauce recipes. But just a word of caution, before using any new substance on a regular basis, you should get clearance from your doctor. Individuals who suffer from diverticulitis, this is a condition in which a person has small pockets in their intestine lining. They need to be extremely cautious not to have seed fragments become trapped in those pockets, and thus should only use finely ground flaxseed or flaxseed oil. So please, before you use anything for that matter, it's advisable for you to rather consult your doctor, inshallah. Well, I hope this will be of some benefit to you all. We'll be back with more, inshallah, next week. But for now, we're going to take a break. And when we return, we're going to be talking to our team of therapists, to Nazreen, Kendall, and Trish. And our topic for discussion this afternoon is cerebral palsy and hypotherapy. Please a reminder to our listeners that this is an interactive program. If you do have any questions or concerns, please do feel free to contact us. The number to dial is 011-854-1548, and you can SMS or WhatsApp me on the number 082-8492-786. Stay tuned. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your host, Sister Zenith, and joining me in the studio this afternoon is the Linasia Community-Based Rehabilitation Team. It's Nazreen, Kendall, and Trish. Good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Wa alaikum salam.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about cerebral palsy today and hypotherapy. I just want to remind our listeners that, if you do have any questions or concerns, or you would like to know more, please do call in. The number to dial is 011-854-1548. Our engineer is waiting to take your calls, and we also have a WhatsApp number, 082-8492-786, for any of your questions. Okay, so cerebral palsy, why did we decide on that today?
The reason why we decided on it was we wanted to speak a little bit about hypotherapy first. So we just needed to explain first what conditions we use in order to treat people using the intervention hypotherapy. So we just thought we'd do a little bit of a background of cerebral palsy first.
Okay. All right. So let's start off. What is cerebral palsy? And, maybe we can also just look at some of the causes of cerebral palsy.
Okay. So cerebral palsy is a condition in which there may be abnormal brain development or injury to the brain as it develops. This can occur before birth, during birth, or during the first 3 to 5 years of a child's life. If a child has cerebral palsy, it means that the part of the child's brain is either not working properly or has not developed normally. The affected area is usually one of the parts which control the muscles and certain body movements. So in some cases, cerebral palsy is barely noticeable, while others will be more severely affected. But no two people will be affected in quite the same way.
So basically, it can affect the child at any stage, during, before, or after birth.
Correct.
Okay, so, how are we going to know what the causes are, say before birth or during birth, or even maybe you can just explain that to us, and after birth too, how are you going to actually pick up that?
Okay, so causes before birth is if the mother consumes any alcohol, drugs or smokes, which results in the death of brain cells of the fetus, or infection during pregnancy, so German measles, your chicken pox or mumps, and having a possible genetic disorder that can pass on to the child.
So if it is in the family,
yes.
There are chances that you may pick it up. Is there chances that it can just come out from nowhere, just picking it from anywhere?
Do you know if there's high chances of, if it's not within the family, if a child can pick it up?
There are more chance of, there's no genetic, unless there's a condition that's affecting the mother and the pregnancy itself. But normally we look at CP kids being affected mostly by a trauma. So whether it's the brain, being affected after the birth, so a knock to the head or near drowning where brain cells died. There's also causes like strokes in very small children, which is a clot that flows through the brain. So those things can be genetic, but there's a lot of causes that come from not being having a predisposition. So I don't think you could say that it's you can inherit it. You could, it's a possibility, but it'll be caused by something that you inherited, something else, like the strokes, the predisposition to having a stroke, or the pregnancy that the mother has, if she has a loose placenta, that can easily become detached, things like that.
Okay.
If that made sense.
All right. So, okay, so that's causes before birth. And during birth, what can happen during birth?
So Kendall just mentioned one, but birthing complications such as the detachment of the placenta or a uterine rupture or problems with the umbilical cord during birth can disrupt the oxygen supply to the baby. And then after birth, like Kendall mentioned, if there's an accident, whether the child has a severe fall on the head, or possibly an accident like drowning or a car accident, as well as infections like meningitis that can affect the brain as well.
So basically what can happen is the brain can be injured, or there's a lack of oxygen at some stage.
Yes, exactly.
Can it affect a person later in life too? if any of these accidents perhaps happen?
So CP is specifically diagnosed with for children. If something else happens to the brain when you're older, it could be a traumatic brain injury, which is a knock to the head, and that's what we would diagnose someone that's older than the ages of. Different research says different things. Some people say it's after the age of 2. Some research says after the age of 5. It's not CP anymore. So maybe Nazreen knows a bit more about the diagnosis, but there's TBI, so traumatic brain injuries, or a stroke, which would happen in adults. But if it happens in a child, then we regard it as CP.
Okay. Yeah, I think as long as it's diagnosed, I think before the age of 5, then it's regarded as cerebral palsy. I think once it goes over the age of 5, it's regarded as something else. So you can have like an adult who had cerebral palsy diagnosed before the age of 5, and if you ask them if they're 18, you know, and if you ask what the diagnosis is, it would still be regarded in rehab as cerebral palsy. That was the original diagnosis, even though they may be 18 years, because it was diagnosed before the age of 5, for example.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting, you know. You never think of it as that way. But anyway, can we look at some of the symptoms of cerebral palsy?
So, cerebral palsy presents in a variety of ways, and as we said, no child presents in the same way. So a child can be either stiff or floppy in terms of their muscles. Some symptoms include exaggerated reflexes, lack of muscle coordination, tremors or involuntary movements, delays in reaching motor skills milestones, such as pushing up on arms or sitting up alone or crawling, difficulty in walking, so they may walk on their toes or have a crouched walk or scissor walk, which is where the knees are crossing, and a wide gait or walk or an asymmetrical one, so the legs don't move the same. Others are excessive drooling or problems with swallowing, and there's also delays in speech or difficulty speaking and seizures as well. The disability associated with cerebral palsy may be limited primarily to one limb or one side of the body, or may affect the whole body. The brain disorder causing cerebral palsy doesn't change with time, so the symptoms usually don't worsen with age. However, muscle shortening and muscle rigidity may worsen if not treated.
Okay, so what you are trying to say, I hope I'm getting it right here, that the symptoms don't usually worsen with age. So whatever symptoms you have as a child is what you're going to be having throughout your life.
So with therapy, there's neuroplasticity where the brain does grow. So we hope to get treatment to the kids as soon as they are diagnosed, so that we can train the brain so that it can actually find other ways to make the movements we want them to get, so they can improve, but we normally don't see them worsen.
Okay, so in other words, if that part of the brain is affected, it's going to be affected for the rest of life. It's not going to get better. So the brain is not going to heal. There's no way it'll get better.
In our experience with the patients that we've had, I haven't actually seen a patient that's improved as such from the diagnosis, the initial diagnosis. They have improved in terms of therapy because we've been able to improve their functioning as such. But in terms of the damage to the brain that's been done, I've never had a patient that I've come across that, you know, the damage has improved or lessened. We've just been able to affect their functioning through therapy.
Okay, so basically what the reason we're doing this program, and I think it's very important that people understand, you know, that you can, okay, it's never going to be, it won't go away, but you can make the person's life so much better. You know, if we leave it, it's going to get worse, I think, the person will never be able to function completely, not, I mean, it's going to be a problem, but the thing is that you will be able to manage to do things better.
So the quality of life, I think, we can have an impact on the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
There's also different levels of CP, so you get like your mild, your moderate, and your severe as well. And that also affects what we call your prognosis, like how functional you will become. And just in terms of worsening, I think there are other conditions possibly that could cause worsening, like if there's uncontrolled epilepsy that sometimes is happens with the diagnosis of cerebral palsy, that does affect the functioning. So the patient can actually regress as well.
But that's not the CP itself regressing. Yeah. That's constant trauma to the brain that's reoccurring. And that's then damaging the brain, yeah.
Okay, so how is cerebral palsy treated? Yeah.
So children and adults with cerebral palsy require long-term care with a medical care team. So it includes a variety of people. So a pediatrician or a medical doctor, and they will basically oversee the treatment plan and the medical care. And then a social worker, and they assist the family to find services and plan for care transitions. A special education teacher or school, and what they will do is they address learning disabilities and they determine the educational needs and identify the appropriate educational resources. And then a speech therapist, so they oversee the speech, the swallowing or language difficulties. A physiotherapist, so they will help with your child to improve the strength and walking skills and stretch the muscles. And an occupational therapist, so they provide therapy to the child to develop daily skills and to learn to use adaptive products that will help with daily activities. But most of the time, for example, at our clinic, the speech therapist, physiotherapist, and occupational therapist will often work as a multidisciplinary team, and so we see the patient together in a session. And we also work together to treat children using a treatment intervention called hypotherapy.
Okay. Now, just before we go on to talk about hypotherapy, and I'm sure many people would want to know what this is all about, how soon can a child be diagnosed with cerebral palsy?
Well, it's if you're going via government, we normally send to the neurodevelopmental clinic where they would go for brain scans. So the child's brain needs to be identified that the damage has been done to the brain. So it's as soon as the damage has been done, the brain scans need to be done and the diagnosis can be made. But the problem is if you're going somewhere via government, there's also long waiting lists to have the child diagnosed. And that all delays the treatment process. So it's as easy as to say once the brain scans can be done, which could be at any age, or once the child is stable. Obviously, if the child's in ICU, they're not going to be taking them out to scan them. But yeah, scanning the brain and just assessing that.
Okay. And with regards home care, as parents or as caregivers, do you think that they can pick up, these little symptoms quickly and try and get help quickly? What are the things that they need to actually, just for them to understand? I mean, you've shared with us some of the, some of the symptoms, but for parents, simpler things, little things that they can look out for them to pick up that, there might be a problem somewhere.
If a baby is, when they're very small, they should be using their arms and legs the same. They're not right-handed or left-handed as yet. Mm-hmm. So if a baby is trying to hold a bottle but only using one hand, if you're noticing that every time you pass them a toy, they're only using one hand, if they are standing up, like you're playing with the child on your lap, and you find that they only use the one leg, or they're delayed in their milestones in terms of they're unable to pull themselves up to standing. The other thing is that's very specific to CP is the stiffness or the floppiness. So the stiffness is what we call as increased tone or hypertonia, and that's when the muscles of the baby are tight. So you'll find their hands and their arms tight against their chest. Even if it's not against their chest, it might just be a closed fist. Or tighter muscles, maybe on one side of the body, maybe on both arms and legs. The same in the lower legs. They might be tight, pointing straight in front of them, or pulling up. So the floppiness is a little bit harder to see when they're younger because moms don't really notice. They think, oh, it's my baby. They're just a little bit floppy. They'll get their strength. But if they are still weak as they start to get older, they're not reaching their milestones in terms of standing and walking, then we know that there's definitely a problem. You should probably have your baby assessed if there were any problems with the birthing process or prematurity or anything like that, just to make sure. Because a lot of the time, the mild children can be missed. Because you don't notice it as soon as they come out. Also, if your baby is having seizures, even if little ones, to be assessed for that as well.
Yeah. I think also that to take note of things like falls, you know, accidental falls on the head, accidents, near drowning incidences, obviously all of those, keeping that in mind and having your baby assessed afterwards as well. And then just to add a little bit onto what Kendall said in terms of the milestones. So if your baby's also not achieving the milestones, but also if you're noticing that there is a difference in the quality of movement that your child is displaying.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, okay, they may not achieve the walking, but if they're achieving the walking and you're finding that there's a difference in the quality of movement or the type of movement as opposed to other children around about that age, and it's consistent, then I think that would warrant a possible, you know, visit to your pediatrician.
Yeah, I think it's so important because, you know, sometimes as new, especially new mothers, maybe, you know, with the second, third baby, you are much more alert.
Mm-hmm.
But with the first baby, you're not sure what is happening. But I think it's very important for you to be, as a parent, to be so alert and aware of your child. And anything, if there's any little problem, you know, you rather go to the doctor and they tell you, please don't worry, there's nothing wrong with the child, than to worry. And I think as a mother, you always have that little extra, you know, that instinct. You somehow just know something's not right. And if it's not, if you feel that way, I think it's so important. Have it seen to, no matter what, no matter how small it is. Because I've noticed and I've realized after doing so many of these programs that there's so much of help available out there that you know, you can do so much for your child when they are small.
Yeah.
You know, when they're very little, they can do so much. You can have with speech therapists, occupational therapists, you know, every kind of therapist is available. So parents shouldn't be thinking that, you know, oh, this is the end of the world.
I just wanted to add on to that as well. We do go to different places to do screening of children.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes what we notice is there isn't a, you know, the parents are not entirely forthcoming in terms of wanting their children screened. So we offer a free service in terms of the screening of the children, especially from 0 to 3 years. And my advice to the parents would be, you know, jump on that. We've got therapists who are trained, we've got professionals who are trained. Don't think, oh, I have to go home now quickly, you know, and I've got so much stuff to do and it's so cold. Just come in for 10 minutes or 5 minutes and let us have a look at the child and see if there is something that we pick up.
That's just the thing. The quicker you pick it up, the quicker you can start with treatment.
Mm.
And, you know, it helps the child because eventually it's for the sake of the child. Mm. And whatever they can do in the first few months or first few years of their life will help them for the rest of their lives.
Mm.
Inshallah. Okay, we're going to take a little break, and when we return, we will continue with our program. Stay tuned. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to Family Health Matters. I'm your host, Sister Zenith, and with me in the studio is the rehabilitation team from the Lanesia Community Based Rehab Team Center here in Lanesia. We have Trish Ventura, who is the physiotherapist, Kendall Greeley, who is an occupational therapist, and Nizreen Hassan, the occupational therapist, who is also the sub-district coordinator for the Johannesburg Metro District. Thank you once again for joining us. And yeah, it's so interesting, you know, talking about this. We really don't know much, you know. It's only, I think, unfortunately, the problem is only when you have a child that has a problem, you know, like this, for instance, if a child is cerebral palsy, then only you will take the initiative to find out more about it. Other than that, I think, unfortunately, you know, we don't worry much about it. But it's so interesting to know more. And alhamdulillah, I hope this program that we are doing today will inform our listeners and give them more information with regards to cerebral palsy. Now, we were talking, you mentioned something called hippotherapy a little earlier in the program. So now let's see what it is and how it can actually help children with cerebral palsy. So what is hippotherapy? Trisha, you're going to come up.
It's Kendall.
Okay.
So hippotherapy falls under the umbrella term of equine-assisted therapy. Hippotherapy is an intervention used with horses. Horses are essential as they are a form of neuromuscular therapy, and they can improve the posture and coordination of the child with disabilities. As mentioned before, the hippotherapy usually involves an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, or a speech therapist working with a client and a horse. Different movements of the horse present challenges to the rider to promote different postural responses. The horse influences the rider rather than the rider controlling the horse.
Okay. So now, you know, talking about this, normally children, little ones, would probably be diagnosed with this. So would this actually be ideal for even little children? Or is there a certain age that you can start this therapy with?
So we limit our children that have CP that come in. I think the age limit is about 5, but it all varies on how the child functions and their size, of course, as well, because you can't put a very small child on there and expect them to improve. It'll probably just do damage. Mm-hmm. They'll be too much for them.
Yeah, they may just be too scared to get onto the horse. I know little ones sometimes do tend to be quite fearful of animals.
We do have some of our CP kids that are very scared of the horses, but we slowly try to get them into the horses. We start off with them playing with or stroking them, playing with the hair, so that they get familiar with the horses before they actually get on them, because we do want the positive relationship between child and horse, as well as the rest of the therapy in terms of the posture and everything.
Okay.
Just to add on to that, so we don't normally take children under the age of 3. And like Kendall said, we try and use the bigger children, depending also on the size of the horse that we have. And then weight is also a limitation. So if the child is very heavy, we don't necessarily allow them then to do hippotherapy as well. In terms of safety, in terms of dismounting the child, if there is something that might happen, like the horse might bolt, we then have to remove the child from the horse very quickly. And if the client is very heavy, then that provides a limitation.
Okay.
As well as we need a bigger horse. If the child's going to be heavy and we may not be tall enough to reach the child on the horse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm sure there's a lot of precaution that's taken and a lot of safety involved with this, mm-hmm. but we'll talk about it a little later in the program or as we go along. So, hippotherapy, how does this actually work?
So, as mentioned before, mm-hmm. you work as a team. So, just with a bit of regards to the setup, you will need a horse, a horse leader, so someone to just guide and control the horse, 2 side walkers to support the patient on either side of the horse, and a back walker. So the back walker just walks a few meters behind the horse just to ensure that the patient on the horse has the correct posture.
Okay, so that's necessary. It's like little safety rules that you have to have these people around the horse with the patient on the horse by.
Yes, especially like Nazrin mentioned, should the horse randomly bolt, one of the therapists on either side need to take the child off very quickly and remove the child from the situation as soon as possible.
Okay. And then with regards to the intervention?
So with regards to intervention, the horses walk with a gait that's similar to human gait, which is variable, rhythmic, and repetitive. So children with an abnormal gait pattern, so such as cerebral palsy, they can be positioned on the horse to experience what a normal gait pattern feels like. So when a person sits on the horse and the horse is walking forward, the horse's pelvis directly influences the movement of the human's pelvis, imitating normal human gait.
So, in other words?
So, just to put it a little bit more in lay terms, if you're on the horse, and then the area that you're sitting on, the horse's pelvis, that movement basically mimics underneath the patient's pelvis movement, and that's how they get stimulated to feel a normal so-called walk pattern from the horse.
Okay. It's interesting.
Okay, and then hippotherapy also provides children with a variety of different sensory stimulations. So one of them is proprioception and weight bearing. So the muscles and joints receive deep pressure stimulation from the bouncing of the horse and holding positions. And I'll get to the positions a little bit later. And then you get vestibular and balance. So the brain uses vestibular stimulation to sense movement and balance as the horse moves. And that's whether the horse moves in circles or up and down hills and changes speeds. And then you get visual stimulation. So vision on a moving horse is one of the only opportunities that a person with impaired mobility may have to experience visual flow while they're actively engaged. And then you get your tactile stimulation. So that's provided by feeling different surfaces on the horse's coat and mane and tail. And that also comes into play when Kendall mentioned when we first start, we want the patient or the child to get used to the horse. So we often say, stroke the horse, feel its mane, talk to the horse, things like that. And then another stimulation is also changes such as the warmth of the horse and the environmental situations like the wind or the weather, basically. And then by using these different sensory stimulations, the patient can be placed in different positions on the horse, such as the child either sits upright facing forward. The child can also sit upright but facing backwards or in reverse. They can also be lying down with their tummy on the horse's back or with the child's back on the horse's back. They can also be on all fours, so like a crawling position, and they can be on high kneeling, so they can be propped up high on their knees. And these are all the various positions we use to stimulate what we want in terms of therapy.
Mm-hmm. So when they are in all these different positions, obviously, you are there to, you know, monitor it all the time, and so the child can...
So that's where the two side walkers come in. So depending on how the child is positioned, for example, the child can also be over the horse on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So one child, if the child's facing towards you, the one therapist may be holding by the elbows and trying to get the child to lift their head, while the side walker on the other side may be holding either by the knees or the feet. It's just dependent on how the position of the child and whether they, how much facilitation they need at the end of the day. Because some children are really stable on the horse and they don't need that much facilitation.
Okay.
I think also, sorry, just, I don't know if you, what you're asking is in terms of safety, is that what you, okay, so the horse leader usually is an individual from the place that the horses are stabled at. So they have a very good idea of the horse's personality and also what type of horse it is. So the horse leader pays a lot of attention to like sort of reining the horse in and controlling the horse at the front and keeping an eye on the sort of psychological state of the horse as well. And looking for any danger signs that the horse is unhappy or the horse is going to bolt, and would then communicate this to the two side walkers. So while the two side walkers are involved with putting the child in the correct position and posture and all of that, the horse leader is very involved with attending to the horse and making sure that the horse is doing what the horse needs to be doing.
Yes, no, I can imagine that. Yeah.
And I just want to say, I think it's also important to note, we put these children in different positions on the horse, but you can also change the horse itself and the pattern that they walk. So Nazreen's been helping us a lot with taking the horse between things so they walk like in a zigzag pattern, and having a trot, starting and stopping, things like that, all challenge the child and their postural tone, and how they hold themselves up and how they deal with the different movements in terms of their trunk and the other benefits of it. So we can change the child and we can change the movement of the horse, and together you can make a very specific therapy for each individual child.
And how long does this therapy, if you are taking the child out, for how long do you normally put the child in on the horse with this kind of therapy? How long does it last?
It's dependent on where we are in therapy. So like I mentioned earlier, the first session we just introduced the horse to the child and got each child used to the horses and how the horses react and things like that. Then from there we started with about twice around in a circle or in the facility around the horse with a different position each time we go around. But as we've been progressing throughout the year, we've increased the number of laps we've done in the facility, or like Kimball mentioned, we changed the way the horse walks. So we put objects in front of the horse or get the horse to walk and then stop. So it's all dependent on where we are in therapy and how much we want to challenge the child at the end of the day.
It's also dependent, to add on to Trish, what Trisha said, it's also dependent on your aims and your treatment goals. So you can sort of aim for a half an hour session, and you can have, let's say, the child on the horse for most of the session. Or what you can do is you can start off with groundwork with the horse. For example, like if you want to actually impart a skill to the child, if the child is a little bit older, you can teach them how to groom the horse, you can teach them how to bridle the horse, how to put the saddle on, how to lead the horse out. And then if that takes up, for example, 20 minutes of that half an hour, and you need to do 10 minutes on the back of the horse, that's also fine. But if you have, for example, like a cerebral palsy child, where you would want to have an impact on the movement, you could do a little bit longer on the horse, and then, like Kendall had mentioned as well, do different types of movements. So the serpentines, which is like the S's, diagonals, going around in different circles, you know, larger concentric circles. Yeah.
So it must be interesting, and you need to have a lot of patience, I guess. But I guess that's what you're trained to do. I'm sure you're trained to do that. So you go out there with a purpose, and you try and get it done.
So the horses are unpredictable. So they are unpredictable creatures by nature, but they're wonderful creatures. So yes, we do have to exercise patience, and there's a lot of watching. So I know the girls come back after that morning quite tired because you're outside, you're walking around a lot, and you're paying a lot of attention to the patient and the horse.
Yeah, I guess so.
And we do groups, and there's a few of us treating at a time. So we also like to do a functional activity before, whether it's the child's taking off their jacket, trying to do zips, or removing their shoes or putting on shoes. They then go on the horse, and afterwards generally a playtime where they have to. There's a nice jungle gym at the facility that we use at Southern Riding Center, and we get them to climb. Each child has a different goal. Some we try to get movements of the arms, others we're just pushing them down the slide so that they can get a certain feedback and stimulation. Some we try to encourage words in the therapy, so getting them to say go before they go down the slide, or counting 1, 2, 3. So we don't only do hippotherapy with the horses, but we also try to do therapy before and after the horse. Especially with the horse stimulating the muscles for walking, the ones that can walk, we try to get them to walk and climb as much as they can after the session as well, now that the muscles have been stimulated.
So basically what happens is that the physiotherapist, occupational therapist, and the speech therapist are all working together, trying to get, you know, to reach their goals with the child, for that matter.
Yes. Yeah. So you can,
wonderful.
You can do activities as well on the horse. So sometimes if you plan your session as such that you have to stop and do a certain activity, then we do that as well.
Okay, so let's just look at some of the advantages of hippotherapy.
So with hippotherapy, it provides numerous benefits, such as affecting muscle tone and improving muscle strength, gross motor skills such as sitting, standing, and walking, improving range of motion, coordination and balance, endurance, head and trunk control, body awareness, posture, eye-hand coordination, oral motor control, voice quality, and verbal communication. So we often get the child to repeat words, to say hello to the horse, command the horse, to go or to stop, and speech is there stimulated after the session with the horse.
Okay. So maybe, you work with them, and you work with all these words that you've just used here, the muscle tone and strength and the gross motor skills. Maybe just, give us in simpler terms, what does it all mean?
So affecting muscle tone.
Sorry about that.
No, that's completely.
All of us. Yeah.
So muscle tone is when we're referring to the muscles being tight or floppy. Mm-hmm. So if the muscles are tight, the heat of the horse relaxes the muscles and helps them to stretch, which will also increase their range of motion, or the range that their muscles can reach, so it stretches them out. That can be done by putting the child in a certain position. Sometimes their muscles on the inside of the legs squeeze very tight, and that pulls the legs together, and that affects the range of motion in their hips to pull the legs apart. So we put them on the horse, put the legs apart, and the heat relaxes the muscles in the legs, and also gives a longer stretch, which then gets the stretch to go for longer.
That's interesting.
Motor skills are things that we talk about. Gross motor skills are anything from being able to sit or stand or walk, throwing a ball, kicking a ball. It can range from any kind of movement skill. So with the horses, we are improving their muscle strength by the challenge of the horse moving and the way it moves, that it moves their trunk or their upper body, and the way they move their hips. All of those things improve their muscle strength, which then is going to impact how they use their body after the horse. So with the increased muscle strength, they can then do more movements on their own.
Amazing. Yes.
Okay, I just want to add on as well that just to emphasize what Trish had said at the beginning, that hypnotherapy, it is a therapy. So it involves an assessment. It involves carryover, like Kendall has said, once we dismount from the horse, there are functional activities that are done. And also the session is planned very carefully. So it needs to be implemented by either a physiotherapist, occupational therapist, or speech and hearing therapist. And also there are diagnoses that are contraindicated for hypnotherapy as well. One of them being Down syndrome. They need to have a full medical and x-rays of the joints of the neck before they actually even look at hypnotherapy, because there's instability of some of those joints of the neck as well. So there are diagnoses that are contraindicated. Not everybody is indicated for hypnotherapy.
Okay. And finally, you know, how are you at the clinic involved, you know, with hypnotherapy?
So Lanasia Clinic, in conjunction with Lanasia South Clinic, work together once a month at the Southern Guiding Center to treat patients.
Okay, so where's the Southern
Guiding Center? It's just off the Eenachem Road.
It's in Akenhof. If you're going straight down towards Akenhof, you'll cross over the Golden Highway, you go straight down, and you'll see that the Lyder Hotel is then on the left-hand side. If you go right towards Tedder Field, then it's not far down that road. It's the Southern Riding Center.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a public-private partnership, so we're allowed to carry out this program by using the horses and facilities free of charge. And patients from each clinic must first be assessed to determine whether they meet the requirements for hypnotherapy. So if the requirements are met, the patient will be referred to our monthly hypnotherapy program. So most of our patients are diagnosed with cerebral palsy. However, it can be used for a number of conditions, but like Nazreen mentioned, you first have to be assessed first to see whether you qualify. But just to mention three conditions is autism, Down syndrome, developmental delay, learning and language disabilities, genetic disorders like scoliosis, and attention hyperactive disorder.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, but like Nazreen mentioned, you first have to be assessed first.
The one you mentioned here, genetic disorder, scoliosis. What is that? Something to do with the back?
The spine.
The spine.
And they have the S curve of the spine. It's not the usual straight down.
Yeah, it's just a deformed spine. Mm-hmm. So the kids often have problems with sitting correctly, and they also have weakness in certain areas. That kind of
muscle imbalances.
Yeah.
So it would actually help. Horse riding or this therapy would actually help. Oh, okay.
Depending on the child, they do need to be specifically assessed to see that there's no danger that could come of putting them in that specific position.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program. We have to end off now. Those contact numbers, I do have them. Do you mind me sharing them with them? It's 011-488-3294. That's the Lanasia Clinic. And 078-9065-308.
That's the first number. I don't recognize that first number.
011-488-3294.
I don't think that's okay. Our clinic number. Yeah.
All right, fine. Then just leave that number. It may be the wrong number. But 078-9065-308.
That's great. Yeah.
You just call, and if you don't get through to them, then you leave a message. They will certainly get back to you again. Inshallah. Thank you so much. It was so interesting talking to you about this hypnotherapy, and of course, also talking about the cerebral palsy. Thank you once again for sharing all that information with us, and we hope to have you with us next month again, inshallah. Thank Amen. You once again.
Okay.
Well, listeners, that's it then from us. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.